Don't go too far. Stay here. So it's not every Sunday or even every 200th anniversary that you get an association minister, a conference minister, and a general minister and president. Somebody must know somebody. A word about this dear friend of mine. We graduated in 1988 from Eden Theological Seminary, one of the seven seminaries at the time associated with the United Church of Christ, with the mission of preparing those called to and for ministry. They did their best with both of us, and I'm not sure what it is they hope to accomplish at the end of 3 years, but this I know. Whatever their model for ministry looks like, they hope it gets as good as Mindy Quellhorst. She is known by her peers and her classmates as the pastor's pastor. She understands in her heart what it means to serve the people of God. And we are very proud of you. So, living my life with the motto that it's easier to get forgiveness than permission, I didn't ask anybody if this was okay, but there's some good news and some bad news to what I'm about to do. The good news is you're about to hear the second shortest sermon ever preached, the shortest being by Father Ross, my former Latin teacher in my Catholic seminary days, who stood up on a Saturday morning and said, "Do good," and then sat down. This is the second shortest sermon, the one that I was prepared to speak, but I'm going to shift in a minute. And that was the danger in celebrating a 200th anniversary is it keeps you more focused on your past than your future. That's it. Now, I had about 15 minutes of rhetorical brilliance to accompany that message, but I'm discarding all of that, and here's the bad news. You're going to get another sermon. Wow, three sermons in one day. That's pretty good. I'm going to take from Paul's letter to the Ephesians. This came in some prayerful reflection this morning. I felt the call to do this, and I'm not even sure why, but I'm going to do it anyway. From Ephesians, "As a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called." I promise you, those German Reformed settlers that landed here 200 years ago and built this church were prepared to live a life worthy of the calling to which they have been called, and you honor their legacy by continuing to do the same. "Be completely humble and gentle, patient, bearing with one another in love, and make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. When we do this, I'll tell you something, that's the world I want to live in. We live in right now a world that is anything but unified in the Spirit through the bond of peace. And we see political factions and theological factions, national factions, tearing the globe apart. And this call to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called by maintaining the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace is what the gospel looks like. That's the world I want to live in. And just so that we're not too ethereal and academic and, you know, impractical about all of this, I want to get down to the tangible and the practical and talk about what I've experienced when the church lives out this calling. So I'm a pastor in Lebanon, Missouri, and a family shows up. Family of four, mom, dad, daughter, and son. David is the son. He's about 18 years old, but he has the mental capacity of about a 5 or a 6-year-old, right? And it's never going to change. He is who he is. And he becomes active in the church, active in the youth group, and what made me so proud is David wanted to be like everybody else, and in our youth group, that's exactly how he was treated. And then confirmation class came around, and David wanted to be confirmed. And what a beautiful year that was. And in that church, the tradition was that the Sunday before Pentecost, we had what we called Preparation Sunday, where those who had been preparing for confirmation stood up in front of the church and read a 2-page essay on what their faith was. And they had to convince us that it was their faith, not grandma's faith, not pastor's faith, not Sunday school teacher's faith, their faith. That's what they were confirming. And in preparing for that, David's father, Bill, came to me and said, "You know David can't do that." And I went, "You're right." He said, "What are we going to do?" And I said, "I don't know." So we promised we would both think about it. A couple weeks go by, and David didn't want to appear different than anybody else, so we couldn't just not do anything. Bill, David's father, came to me and said, "I've got this figured out. Do you trust me?" And I said, "Yes." He loved his son. I knew I could trust him. It's now Presentation Sunday. All of David's classmates had come up and read their essays. David would be the last confirmand to come forward. And as he got up to come forward, Bill, his father, came up with them. The two of them came up, stood at the pulpit. And Bill looked down at his son, David. There were no papers in his hand. And said, "David, who is God?" And David, a little nervous, you could tell he wasn't used to being in front of people, said, "Well, God made me." And then Bill looked at him and said, "Who is Jesus?" "God's son." "And what do you know about God and Jesus?" "They love me." This is the most beautiful confirmation of one's faith that any of us had ever seen. And this church, living out long before we had the language to express it, the notion that no matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, you're welcome here, was realized so beautifully that day, and that's the world I want to live in. Right? Last March, I'm walking down the streets of Palestine, having walked through the ghettos in which those refugees are forced to live. And let me tell you, it's bleak. I've been to the checkpoints. I had been to the checkpoints where every day they have to show their IDs in order to get from their home to their place of employment and reverse and back again the next night. I'd sat in the living room of a mother whose 15-year-old son had been gunned down by Israeli soldiers while playing soccer with his classmates on the school playground. I had been to a checkpoint where a woman, being cornered by a guard, reached into her pocket to get her ID, and he thought she was reaching for a gun and killed her. These are the streets of Palestine that I walked down. And that day, walking down a narrow, crowded street with vendors on both sides hawking their wares and cars trying to navigate their way through the crowd of people, a minivan came out of a side street and was turning its way slowly, trying to inch down the street. And in the passenger side of that car was a little girl. And she had a bottle of water. And she was squeezing it and watching the arc of water just flow through the air, not paying attention to anything around her. And I had to jump out of the way to keep from being soaked by the water bottle. And she saw me jump and realized, "Oh my gosh, I'm in trouble now." And I smiled. And she saw the smile and went from, "Uh-oh, I'm in trouble," to this beautiful smile that said, "Hi." And so I said back to her, "Hi." And she said to me, a perfect stranger, "What's your name?" I said, "John." "What's yours?" "Sama." I said, "Sama, you're beautiful." Her eyes lit up, her mouth lit up, and she just started giggling. And she turned to Mom and Dad with pride to make sure that they heard it. And she just kept laughing, and right about then, the crowd broke, and the van pulled down the street, and they got all the way to the bottom of the hill, and I could still hear her laughing. Now, I don't know what it's like as a 6-year-old to live in those streets and not lose your smile or fear of a stranger, but that's the world I want to live in. In 2013, New Mexico became a marriage equality state. And a young associate pastor, on the day that it would become legal to perform same-sex marriages and same-gender marriages in the state of New Mexico, called the senior pastor of her church in Albuquerque and asked permission to do something. And he gave her permission. He was away. And so she took out a piece of cardboard and a Sharpie and wrote on the cardboard, "I stand ready to marry you," and then went to the courthouse with her sign. 2 weeks later, she and the senior pastor had performed over 90 same-sex marriages. And in fact, when same-gender couples went to the courthouse proudly asking for their marriage license, they handed the couples the card from those pastors and Church of the Good Shepherd in Albuquerque, saying, "If you want a church wedding," one couple from Texas flew to Albuquerque, because Texas had not yet become a marriage equality state, with a nurse, because one of the two was on hospice and was dying. But he heard about that church and those pastors, and with the nurse accompanying them, they flew to Albuquerque, where she performed their wedding only weeks before the one would die. A year later, it's October 17th, 2014, and we're almost certain that on that day, the Attorney General will end the legal battles that were being fought to prevent Arizona from becoming a marriage equality state. Knowing this was coming and remembering what that pastor did in Albuquerque a year before, we made these slick signs that said, "We stand ready to marry you." And we had 150 clergy deployed throughout the state of Arizona that day performed over 200 weddings. I would be standing outside the courthouse when the Attorney General held the press conference and conducted the first legal same-gender wedding in the state of Arizona. But the story I want to tell you about is the second one. Standing right behind me as we did that first wedding with a crowd of photographers, and it would be on the front page of the Arizona Republic the next day, was a couple from Nashville, Tennessee, whose plane landed in Arizona on their way to Las Vegas about an hour earlier. And they were in the gate waiting for their plane to Vegas when the news flashed across the screen that the Attorney General had just declared Arizona a marriage equality state. And they looked at each other, caught a cab, drove downtown outside the county courthouse, and just thought, what could possibly happen now? They just wanted to soak it in, and they see somebody standing holding one of those signs. And they came up to me and said, "Are you serious?" "Yes." "When can we do it?" "Now." "Where?" "Right here." "How much?" "I'm not charging anything." So this couple, who woke up that morning in Nashville, Tennessee, having no idea that when they went to bed that night they would be married, stood there and received the grace of a God who offers love freely to you no matter where you are on life's journey, and that's the world I want to live in. 3 weeks ago, I was in South Dakota. And I was meeting with the pastors from the Dakota Association. It's the only association in the United Church of Christ that's not bound by conference geography. It's our churches on the Native reservations in North Dakota, in Nebraska, in South Dakota. And of course, we talked about Standing Rock and what was going on there. In the 2 days that I was with them, they received 3 calls about how youth on the reservations where they live had committed suicide. It is the highest rate of suicide for any demographic in our country anywhere. Young men and women living on reservation lands. And Toni Buffalo and her husband Byron told me a story about how the week before they took about 10 horses, put them in the trailer, carried with them not only the horses, but about 8 young men and women from the reservation who had never ridden on a horse before. And when they got about 30 miles away from Standing Rock, they got out, They saddled up the horses, and they rode 30 miles from that spot to Standing Rock and listened to Toni Buffalo and her husband Byron talk about what it means to be a member of a First Nations tribe and how these horses used to be their way of life. And over 30 miles of talking about that, they began to feel a sense of pride and purpose and belonging and identity that had really been taken away from them. They arrived there at the site where the Dakota tribes are gathering and demonstrating for water rights. And the leaders of the tribe saw them ride up and asked them if they would go all the way up to the front lines where they were being met by armed guards and act as sort of a shield of protection for their people. And they felt such pride. And the day would end. They would pack up the horses and they would go back home. And the next day when morning broke, school would open up and they were not there. And everybody began to wonder and worry, where are they? And Toni and Byron went out to the corral and there they were with the horses. They had found a way of being that they didn't want to let go of. A sense of purpose and an identity. This is the world I want to live in. Grace United Church of Christ, you were a part of a household and a family of faith that for generation after generation after generation has lived out a calling worthy of that to which we have been called, preaching the gospel of redeeming and transformative love to all the ends of the earth, and seeking with each new day to build a just world for all. And that's the world I want to live in. Run with perseverance the race that is set before you, surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses who from one generation to the next have told and taught you and showed you by word and deed what it means to preach the gospel of love, and know that surrounded by those witnesses, you are called to do just that very thing yourselves. Janine is right. You have a future. There's another 200 years plus for you if we seek to live the calling to which we have been called, maintaining the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. And that, my friends, is the world I want to live in. And you can make it happen. Amen.